Pentecost 8.
Hey, good morning to everybody. We resume our marathon meeting in London. And we're going to talk about the IAS 1. April is here.
Okay, thank you, Hans. This is agenda paper 8, which is the classification of liabilities as current or non-current. In October, you agreed a number of proposed amendments to IAS 1 that were based on whether, at the end of the reporting period, a contractual arrangement was in place which would result in the deferral of the settlement of the liability for at least 12 months. You were concerned, however, that this principle is redundant because the main classification principle is already contained in paragraph 69 of the standard. That paragraph lays out the four criteria for the classification of a liability as current. This articulation, laying out the criteria for current classification, contrasts with the approach taken in October, which focused on the basis for non-current classification. We think, however, that the two approaches would give the same result to a classification decision, and so today we'll re-present the October decisions to you for affirmation, but with the arguments in support of the proposed amendments in the form based on the current articulation and the standard, that is, based on the four criteria for current classification. And in the second part of the paper, we'll consider the effect of events after the reporting period on the application of the right to defer settlement of the liability. The paper provides some background. The criteria for current classification, which is the key principle, are noted in paragraph 11 of the paper. We think that the first three of these criteria are generally clear and consistently applied, but the classification decision becomes more complex when the fourth criterion is considered, the entities not having a right to defer settlement, as set out in paragraph 69D of the standard. So if we can look first of all at affirming the October decisions, you agreed to the removal of unconditional from unconditional rights in paragraph 69D of the standard for the reasons that are given in paragraph 21 of the paper. Do you still agree with that decision?
We do.
Yep.
I agree.
On the table.
Yes.
Yes.
You also agreed in October to make it explicit that settlement for the purposes of classification relates to the transfer of cash or other assets for the reasons given in paragraph 23. In the paper, we also recommend extending that wording to include the transfer of services. This is in anticipation of the revenue standard, when liabilities with respect to performance obligations will also apply. Do you agree with the recommendation to include by the transfer of cash, other assets, and services in the requirements?
Philippe?
I do not disagree in principle. I'm just wondering whether it's really needed to include services. We are talking about financial liability that we settle. Is it really that frequent that a financial liability is settled by rendering services? And if so, I think it raises a number of questions about the timing of the provision of such services, because are we now talking about the classification of the maturity of the liability or the classification of the timing of the services? And then we have to go to revenue recognition to determine what is the timing of the services to be rendered, because if you begin rendering the services during the period covered by, say, the 12 months, but it extends beyond 12 months for the provision of services, the performance obligation is a continuing one. I think we are getting into revenue recognition. It becomes quite complex. And I think we are creating here, opening up a box, a Pandora box. I'm not sure we really need to include services because it's such a rare situation.
Although in the future, some liabilities will be settled by services.
Well, in the present, they are.
And in the present, they are.
This is the reality.
Yes.
Can you give me an example of a financial liability, like a loan being settled by rendering services?
This isn't just about financial liabilities, is it?
Well, yeah.
Because, I mean, paragraph 69 does refer to liabilities generally. It doesn't
agree,
limit itself to financial liabilities.
Is it a liability that arises out of a performance obligation under revenue recognition, or is it a liability that arose out of something else? I'm a bit concerned about the interaction between the revenue recognition standard and this classification question here. What is the source of this liability that we talk about here?
Well, at the moment, you do have liabilities in the balance sheet which are based effectively on your performance obligations, because people have amounts which are amounts invoiced but not performed,
yeah,
or amounts due but not paid, that sort of thing. So you will have existing liabilities which are being extinguished by services.
So this classification... This classification
you could
question...
You also have prepayments that are based on services.
So that would be an extension, in a way, of the standard on revenue recognition. Because it's how to classify a contract liability that we have in the standard on revenue recognition, how to classify it in terms of maturity when such liability is the result of a contract liability.
I don't think that the timing of the satisfaction of performance obligations was specifically addressed in the revenue project.
This is my question. Yes, is it actually an amendment or complementary to, in addition to the revenue recognition standard?
I think that's just naturally falls because this is dealing with classification of all liabilities. So any service-related liabilities will automatically come in.
I think we would have to explain the basis for conclusion then of the amendment.
Okay.
What kind of liabilities are we talking about here?
But if the service is provided over a period longer than 12 months, is it then really settled, and is that really then a current liability? And that is, I think, is the question.
And you will have part of the performance obligation classified as short term or current, and part as non current.
Well, wouldn't I think, as the standard is written today, 69 says an entity shall classify a liability as current when. So we're talking about any kind of liability, not just financial liabilities, but the. Then 69A says it expects to settle the liability in its normal operating cycle. And I think that would cover performance obligations for most of the part, because if their normal operating cycle is longer than 12 months, it would still be classified as current if that was their normal operating cycle. It is my understanding of the way it works today. So I think it's only when the normal operating cycle is 12 months or less that you would have a problem with a revenue recognition liability, a performance obligation. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Jungwoo?
Just a small minor clarification. On paragraph 24, the convertible bond case was raised at the last meeting. So that issue was can be handled by this improvement of your wording, right?
Yes, that's right. We did talk to a couple of people from the FI team about this. This issue had been addressed in the previous amendments to IAS-1, which was when the reference to the counterparty and the option for the convertible loan had been included. Their view was that in most cases, the convertible loan would be covered by paragraph C. The liability is due to be settled within 12 months after the reporting period or not. Now, we could make it absolutely explicit by including transfer of cash, other assets, the issuer's own shares or services. But we didn't think that was actually required. But, I mean, we could make it absolutely explicit if that were felt to be necessary.
So you're saying, you know, you don't need to state explicitly including our own equity?
We haven't done that in the proposal because we think that this was fairly comprehensively addressed in the previous amendments, which were, I think, 2009.
Actually, paragraph 69D, the last piece of that, actually identifies that we're the counterparty with the option of demanding settlement, that doesn't affect the classification of the liability. You would stick with, where you've got a convertible, you would stick with the cash settlement requirements in terms of the classification.
Okay. Right. In October, you also agreed to amend paragraph 73 of the standard. Now, paragraph 73 deals with the rollover of a borrowing that results in a non-current classification. So the first question is, do you affirm that the October decisions to replace discretion with right in paragraph 73 to harmonize that with paragraph 69D and the inclusion of with the same lender or consortium of lenders as discussed in paragraphs 30 to 31 of the paper?
Sue?
I wasn't involved in the October decision, so apologies if I'm repeating stuff that's been discussed before.
Well, you were preparing the papers.
No? Not for this, not current agenda. So a couple of thoughts. Firstly, I think my comments are coloured slightly by the fact that I have a broader issue with what's in IS1, but I have to live with what's in here, because I think that the problem that we're really facing in its essence is that I'm not sure that paragraph 69D and 73 are really talking about the same thing, which is why I think the confusion's arisen, because 69D is talking about the terms of a particular liability, which could have extension or prepayment features in it, and 73 is going on to talk about new liabilities that might replace the first one. And so that's where the tensions start to arise. Now, the thing that troubles me with the whole extension that's introduced by paragraph 73 is that it really means that you're using liabilities that you're not accounting for yet to classify whether your current liability is current or non-current. So you're saying, because I'm going to replace it with another liability from the same lender, I'll treat this dated liability as if it actually isn't repayable within the next 12 months. I don't agree with that, but IS1 paragraph 73 already has that in it. But it does create a sort of tension between our normal classification and recognition and measurement criteria and our classification criteria. So I'm keen not to increase that tension by broadening what's in IS1. So I wouldn't agree to including things like consortiums in here personally, because I think you could have a very different group of lenders. At some point, what's the difference between me saying I've got a liability which is due to be repaid within the next 12 months, but I know that I've already got this other bank that's completely disconnected with this liability lined up to refinance it. There's not much difference between the two, and I think the more we move away from the same lender, the more that we move toward that other scenario, so I'd prefer not to go there.
I mean, part of the reason that we have put this more specific thing is because you're right, 73 is an outline sort of concept which is not within the sort of the usual tenor of the classification things, and what we've tried to do is make it as specific as possible to ring fence those possibilities as much as possible. Now, we brought in the thing about the consortium because when this was put out for comment 2 years ago, a lot of people came back and said there's no point in talking about same or similar lenders unless you take into account consortia, because that's the more usual structure, and they thought we had to cope with that, so that is why we took it in.
Yeah, I understand that, but I don't agree.
We don't.
And on the discretion point, my concern with right and also actually with removing the word unconditional from 69D, although we've already decided that, is if you say to me that I have the discretion to refinance, that sort of gives me the impression that it's just my choice, and other than that, it's sort of all a done deal. If you say that I've got a right, that to me, I could come and ask you, but maybe you have the ability to say no. Maybe I've got the right to ask, but there's conditions attached. I don't think it's as strong as just discretion.
We saw it the other way around. If anything, we saw right as being stronger and clearer than discretion, which was the reason for our proposal here.
I don't agree, because I think there was a reason before we would have had unconditional right, because I think I can have a right to ask, but I might have to satisfy certain conditions. I'm just not sure that it's clear enough for me personally that it's completely within my control, if you like, and certain enough that I'd be happy to go beyond looking at the terms of the current liability, the liability I currently have, to a new financing
if there's any uncertainty about whether I can actually access that financing. So.
But then the right will be conditional.
But we've removed the word unconditional.
Okay, so your point is to keep unconditional in the text.
I'm okay with unconditional, but I just worry about moving from the discretion. I think it weakens it further.
Gary? Actually support the staff's recommendations, and I do think, and I resonate with a lot of the points Sue made, but I think very few rights are truly unconditional in the world, and that's part of it. But I think on the definition of lender, I mean, you mean that sort of broadly the group, because lending inside, you know, going to a major multinational banks, I mean, one loan might be with different legal entity than another at the same time, so you're really meaning the group as a whole. Just want to clarify, that's what you meant. I agree with that. I also resonate with the point. The consortium should be sort of a continuing corpus of members, but, you know, some of these consortiums might have 100 pieces of third and fourth level action, you know, underneath it. So I think you got it right that it's, you sort of look at, does it substantially stay together? You know, particularly the lead banker, I think that's very, very important, because they sort of set the tenor of the entire arrangement, including managing, you know, the underlyings.
Stephen?
I don't agree with softening all of this. I think we should say strict on what is current and not push the envelope. It just seems to me that now this classification, current, non-current, is so blunt, and if we want to develop accounting in this area, we need to develop better disclosures about capital structure and the ability to refinance and all the circumstances and the maturity of these liabilities. And just pushing the envelope to get more stuff classified as non-current, I don't think is the way to go. So I don't like the idea of this consortium, and to me it just seems like a different loan. The fact that I've got a right to raise that finance, I don't see there's much of a difference between a similar but slightly different consortium and a completely different lender, as Sue was saying. I think we're going too far in this.
Mary?
I share the concern about going too far with opening it up to a consortium. I, having reflected on the changes and hearing comments this morning, reinforces to me that if it's the same or similar lender, that's the exception. Sorry, the wording is with the same lender, that's the current language, and I think we stick with that. The notion that you're going, when the loan matures, you're going to get a new loan is not radical, but it does mean the current loan is, the loan that you have currently is current, because it will be repaid. I just, even if we got a lot of comments, I don't think we should expand it. Can I go back to one point just to add a comment about the issue that Chung Wu raised, this issue around using own shares to settle. I think that it would be helpful in the basis for conclusion if we point out that if an instrument is classified as a liability under IS 32 and therefore subject to this, so we just make the distinction of why you could be settling something that's classified as a liability with own shares, because we do get into a situation in which own shares are viewed as currency, to settle certain obligations. And I think rather than opening up that can of worms, it would be best to say, remember, you're looking to 32 to see which items are subject to this section. And just a heads up, I've got a couple comments about later on the section on expected breaches, but hold it till we get there.
Hans, this is Pat. Can I jump in?
Yes, Pat.
The observation that Stephen made is one that I'm very empathetic to. But when this discussion began, one of the things that I pointed out was the observation that Gary had, which is it is extremely rare. In fact, I've never seen it that any credit agreement is completely unconditional. Such that a borrower, has the unconditional right to refinance or roll over a loan. There's always covenants and reps and warranties in these documents that make them conditional. So if we were to retain that language, I think a very strict reading of them would say that you would always have to classify a borrowing as current, because it wouldn't meet the strict letter of that standard. These proposals, I think, are a reasonable way to deal with the type of language that you find in credit agreements, and I'm willing to support the staff's recommendation. One observation I would make with respect to the membership of a consortium is instead of saying that it's really within, you know, management's discretion to decide whether the membership hasn't changed, I would make it objective and say if a majority of the membership, including the lead banker, has not changed, then it's with the same consortium. Otherwise, it wouldn't be considered the same. And that's a standard I think most people have used in practice.
This with consortium, I think we can take it away as I see it. The same lender is what we should have in my mind. And if you have a group of five banks or something, it should be the same lenders. So if you change the consortium, as like Pat indicated, that sort of a majority stays there, I think it's a totally new situation. And it's sort of a, from my point of view, new loan. Secondly, I think a little bit like Steve here, that a lot of the changes we talk about here, I don't understand why we do that. I think most of it is just moving a little bit words around, softening the language. We have a little bit later on, we have one substantial thing, but I'll come back to that.
Can I ask what the vote would be about keeping or not keeping consortium in this? Just bearing in mind that when we exposed this previously, people said it wasn't really operational to say same or similar lenders, because so often it was a consortium position, so it wouldn't apply.
But isn't that the same lender? If you have the five banks and you renew with the same five banks, isn't that the same?
And it would if the consortium were exactly the same.
Yes,
consortium,
but what people
exactly
strive for is to have more freedom and pick and choose and change banks.
Jan, my understanding of what we're trying to achieve here is a circumstance where the lead maker, the decision-making banker, has remained the same. But one or two people in the background have changed. Now that almost from the perspective of the borrower is not particularly relevant, because it's the lead banker who's arranging the syndicate.
But is it a new loan?
It is a new loan.
Well, if it is part of a renewal facility that was contained in the original loan,
you'd still account for a new loan under 39.
The question is, though, if we allow you to renew with the same lender and say that's fine, and I think that's what this is about. This is about whether or not the definition of same lender, which we do allow, should incorporate syndicates where one or two members of the syndicate have changed, but not the decision-making members of the syndicate.
I think it's a bit deeper than that, because I think when we exposed same lender, people came back and said that's simply not operational because there are consortiums and consortiums will change both the proportion and the members of it, and what do we do in that case? And they wanted guidance on whether or not that is the same lender.
It seems to me, and just maybe the point I think Steve and Jan might have been making, I mean, if Are you comfortable with a renewal facility with the same lender as a starting point?
Yes.
Because the problem here is then when do you cross over from saying the changes in the syndicate mean that it's no longer qualifies as the same lender? And Jan, it sounded like you were saying we could leave it to the guidance and people can figure it out.
Yeah, I think I see two different situations. One is that you have a lead and that lead is channeling the money. So the other people pay into the lead, and you then have the relation between the company and the lead syndicate leader. Or you have a syndicate where you have agreements with each and every bank. And I think if you have one leader and you deal with him and he deals on behalf of others, and that those behind there is changing, but you don't have a contract with anyone but the lead, then I think it's okay. But if you have direct relations with five banks and that changes, it changes. It's a new loan.
Wow. Gary.
The actually, I think Jan, your last comment addressed some of my concerns. I think typically these consortiums, these are legal contracts, and I think the central thing is the lead arrangers, or the, you know, whoever's the head of the syndicate, is they set the tenor. But, you know, a typical, like a major revolving credit agreement or standby facility, there might be 100 banks in these things. They're, I mean, banks, they get bought, they get sold, they need the business, but it's up to the lead arrangers to keep that contract together. So I would think, you know, the typical lendor or in there would be, the typical entity who's expecting the benefits of the arrangement is expecting, if it's a $2 billion line, that there's $2 billion available through this contract, and it's the lead banker's responsibility to keep $2 billion of financing in place. And if you had contracts with five different banks and one can change in your example, then I think then you have contracts with four banks, you know, not five. Now, whether they're a group or five individuals, I would agree with you.
I think Hughes made a useful point for the staff, that the staff might like to think of it in terms of, does the credit risk stay the same?
Credit risk for the bank?
Yes.
What does that matter?
In determining whether if this whole thing, whether it's a new loan or not a new loan, I think if the credit risk is identical to what it was before, same however it is measured, that to me would be the key thing.
So is that something new? And because that doesn't say it in here at the moment.
No, it's not in there at all. I'm just saying that's how one would ought to think about it.
On the other side.
Amaru.
Thanks. Well, we are talking about an exception here, right? So when it comes to paragraph 7.3, the way I read this in practice, the same loan. When you go to paragraph 7.3, we might be going a little bit further and open up for interpretations here in the application, because we don't use the same loan. We use under an existing loan facility. So I think if we change a little bit the language here, the wording, under this same loan, so this will reduce the tension between is this a new loan or not, under the same loan. And then we reduce also the pressure on the consortium aspect, because we are talking the same loan. I think the opening is that we are concentrating the discussion on the lender. But I think maybe the tension is before, because under an existing loan facility, to me, is different from under the same loan. Well, if we are talking about an exception, we should be as strict as possible in this. So my suggestion is, let's concentrate in the loan itself, and then we'll reduce the tension on the lending aspect.
Larry?
My logic is quite similar to Amaro's. This is an exception. We, you know, in the standard currently it says existing loan facility has the discretion to refinance or roll over an existing loan facility. we proposed same lender and explaining what that means, and people said, well, it won't work unless you make it broader. And so we're focusing on how do we make it broader to satisfy, as opposed to going back and saying it's an exception. If it won't work unless it's broader, then maybe it won't work. And I think we should just stick with this and not start to create confusion about, if you get this new loan, is it really a new loan that you have to account for as a new loan, when I think we don't see that being a question. So I just think we should end the pain and say, This is the limit of the exception.
But Mary, what we're trying to do is get to the right answer, isn't it, on what's current and what's non-current, whether it's an exception or not. I mean, to just say because it's an exception, let's be tough and rule it out, I don't think that's a good argument at all.
But I also don't think that a new loan that replaces an old loan means the old loan isn't repaid and therefore isn't current. So in terms of what the
we're
right...
We're trying to decide whether it's a new loan or not. That's really the point.
Peter.
I think in the discussion so far it seems people have assumed that if we don't include the syndicate, it'll or the question is the whole loan in or out if we're talking about syndicates? But I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because I think if we stick with just the same lender, the continuing members of the syndicate will be continuing loans and the new members will be new loans. And so I think one question is, do we want to split it in that way?
Okay, thank you for making it more difficult.
Sorry, it's just a jump. That's why my suggestion to concentrate in the loan itself, and then the pressure on the who is the lender will diminish significantly.
I ask myself, why do we have a current non-current split? And it's primarily for users of financial statements. So why is it important to users of financial statements? And I think that the importance is that they're trying to get a handle on the amount of cash that the company is going to have to come up with in the next 12 months. And so it seems to me, if you're rolling over a loan with the same lender, then you don't have to come up with the cash. It's just going to go out. If it's a new lender, then you've got to come up with cash to pay off the old lender, get the new loan from the current lender. There's slightly more risk involved, and so you would want to see that loan as current. When it's a consortium,
it's non-current. That line is current or non-current?
Current.
If it's with current. The same lender, it would be current. If it's a different lender, it would be non-current, because there's more risk involved that there may actually have to be a cash outflow.
Other way around.
Well,
other way around. Right. Different lender, current.
Yeah. No.
Right. Yes. Different lender, current. Right. Right. Sorry.
Okay. Now I understand why you guys find this so difficult.
Yes. because there's more risk. So you've got the consortium, and so what to provide information that's useful to lenders, we want to identify those situations where there's a high risk or some risk. I guess some risk, not necessarily a high risk, but some risk that the entity will have to come up with cash in the next 12 months. And I'm not really that familiar with banking activities, but it seems to me that if the lead lender, if it's part of the existing loan facility, that they can refinance with the consortium with the same lead lender and the agreements with the same lead lender, that there's little risk that they'll have to come up with cash because it's in place and the lead bank is responsible for the rest of the consortium, has always been my understanding, but that may be wrong. But to the extent it's in the existing loan facility that they can refinance with the same consortium, same lead bank, to me that should be non-current, because there's not going to be any cash outflow because they're going to refinance. But I could misunderstand. But to me, it's all about whether or not there's a risk they're going to have to pay out cash in the next 12 months.
Sue?
I agree with Pat that it seems that the distinction that we've been comfortable to make in IS1 is based on this sort of notion that there's less risk if you're dealing with the same party versus having lined up refinancing, which means you might not have to actually have cash, you might be able to arrange it directly, but there is another party involved. So if we want to extend that logic, and if we want to extend to consortiums, I think it would be useful in the basis to explain that that's the logic. The logic is that there is no sort of cash flow risk because you're dealing with the same counterparty, to make sure that when people are looking at whether they're sort of arrangement meets the criteria that we're aiming for, that is how the mechanics work. Because to your point, I'm not sure that every consortium in the world is going to work in that way, and so I think we need to be careful what we're signing up for. So I think if we're going to go with consortium, can we make it clear that that's the logic that we've used to make the distinction between just another refinancing?
Can I ask if this is the interpretation that we could live with? The approach we could offer. No. Stephen, no?
Well, I think if you start on a new principle of no cash flow risk, then to my mind that opens up the door to more of this. Because if I have a cast iron agreement with a different lender and it's completely unconditional, I can say, well, I've got no cash flow risk. I'm going to get the cash there, it's going to go straight there, and it'll repay the liability, therefore it's all non-current.
But that's what they're doing today in practice, and that's why we're trying to limit it to the same lender?
I agree, yes. Keep it narrow. But as soon as you start with a principle of no cash flow risk, then it seems to me that potentially you open it up to new loans.
I'm just concerned about how useful the classification will be if we're very strict about not being able to roll over.
Is a way of trying to bridge the gap to say same lender in the wording,
yeah,
and then to describe the concept in the context of consortiums and the...
Yes, I mean, as I saw this, we're sticking with the principle of the same lender, and the question that we got back from the last outreach was, well, how do you apply the concept of same lender when it's a consortium?
And Michael, this is Pat again. One way to do that, I know in practice, has been to say you have the same lead bank with the same overall majority in the consortium. If the majority stays the same, then you have the same consortium.
Not then saying that what we want to do is use the word same lender, and then perhaps in the basis then describe that in certain circumstances, a consortium agreement may lead to circumstances where in effect you're dealing with the same lender even if the underlying change. So we do it all around that word.
That's what I would recommend, but I would recommend that we put it actually into the standard itself rather than into the basis.
Mm-hmm. Why?
I don't know how you
Why?
Do that.
Because the basis isn't authoritative. If this is going to be useful, relevant explanation, then I think it should be in the standard.
I think that's a mistake. I mean, I think we should have the same lender. And I think Amaro has a point when he talks about the contract. You have a contract, and that contract stays, and you can roll it over. And the more we open up for to be able to go in between and find new solutions, I think it's a mistake.
And I think the reason why I like the idea of the basis of conclusions is because we keep the term same lender clean,
yeah,
but then simply describe that in some circumstances, same lender might involve more than one people in a consortium situation. And if I have the same certainty that I had if I had the same individual lender from a consortium, even if some people in the background are changing, that might be considered the same.
Isn't it just going to come back to the Interpretations Committee for a definition of some?
It will. I think what I'm trying to capture is the circumstance in which the contractual agreement that I have gives me the same certainty, even if they are moving parts, as if I've got a contractual agreement with a single lender.
But assume you have five banks, and two of them drop out. Now you only have three. And then you fulfill sort of this requirement. These three, perhaps they're not strong enough.
But I think Amaro's point is a good one. We keep focusing on the identities of the lenders as opposed to under an existing loan facility. And if you have a consortium of five, how does the consortium fulfill its obligation to renew or roll over under an existing facility? And that's maybe where we have to put more of the focus.
Yeah, because my experience is, these banks, if you're in a consortium or something, you just don't decide to drop out. I mean, you yourself have a contract with the arranger. You've been paid commitment fees to stand by for the terms. I think the lead banker's job is to keep...
Are we now getting close to a solution, or are we just going in circles?
Could we say same lenders under an existing facility?
No.
It would be good, yeah.
Could I just ask? I think we've got
April.
Sorry, I think we have three possible options. We don't revise the standard. We keep it as it is, which puts the pressure on what's the nature of the loan. Is it an existing arrangement to roll over the loan? Or we put in additional guidance to say it must be the same lender. Or we go the whole enchilada and say same lender and refer to consortium. Could I have an indication just of who would go with making no changes and putting the tension on the definition of the loan itself?
Can I make a comment before?
Yeah.
Because apart from all this discussion, I still think I agree with Mary, I have a point. I think the wording is creating this. When we use the an existing facility. I think it should be the existing facility, because this will clarify that we are talking about that low one. Because an existing facility can be, at the end of the day, any facility to renew or roll over.
2 points.
Okay, who would go with keeping as it is, although changing an to the? 1, 2, 3. So that
how many?
Looks like our preferred.
How many?
Sorry. 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Pat, on the phone.
I'm going with the staff recommendation, and I suggest the additional wording I had mentioned. I'm not quite sure that's what April is asking for.
So I agree with the staff recommendation.
We've taken a vote in the room for people who would like to stay it as it is, but clarify it for Amara's comment, and that achieved 13 of the vote, so that seems to be the preferred option.
What do you mean by as it is?
It's the standard. Yeah,
not as it is at the moment in the standard, which is not taking in same parties, not taking in.
No. The current language is entity expects and has the discretion to refinance or roll over an obligation under an existing loan facility. So it's
under the, and we change that to under the existing loan facility. And that the existing loan facility would in itself define that it must be with the same lender and it must be with the same consortium or what have you, so that we're putting the tension on defining what the loan is that's being rolled over rather than what the counterparty is.
It must be with the same consortium, but the members can change then if we change to the. I think that is really
well,
the relevant
point. Assuming that that is implicit in using
right.
that
the
wording.
Members of the consortium can change, but it's the consortium.
I rather prefer the current staff recommendation, and you are talking about the function of the leading bank. And actually, the function of leading bank is very important in the consortium loan. And even though the contract could be held within the individual banks, but I think the most of the consortium loans is totally depends on the ability of the relationship between leading bank and the borrower. So therefore, you mentioned the function of the leading bank, and it gives much clearer guidance to the constituents.
But Madison, didn't we take a vote?
Vote.
Okay,
right.
Let's move on.
Okay, the paper then goes down on to discuss the significant.
Sorry, have we decided on the replacing the word discretion with right?
Yes.
Yes.
The majority, I think, agreed.
Okay.
Do you want a show of hands?
I don't know.
Is that word in there still?
No, at the moment the word is discretion.
Okay.
I think what the debate really was is which is the stronger word, and we had different opinion what connotated stronger word, discretion or right.
Your proposal to replace right, but right as explained in paragraph 30b, that is the only condition is the entity's willingness, which means there is no other condition. It is unconditional in a way, the way you describe it.
That's what some people described it as in the comment letter analysis.
Is it the way you propose your interpretation of right in the way you propose it? The only condition to this right is the entity's willingness to act and not, no other condition, right?
That contrasts with a variety of views of what discretion means. Personally, I think discretion is much weaker than a right. I think if you have the right to do something, that's weaker than if you have the discretion to do something.
But it's about the question asked by Sue, that is a right unconditional? What is your response to this point?
But you haven't
it's only condition. To the right is entities wants to act. That's only condition. It's not a condition, even. It's just the entity's ability to use a right without any condition.
Isn't that the problem? What we said, it must
we've
be.
Taken, sorry, but we've taken decisions on all these things before.
No,
so what has changed in the meantime that we are having these.
We have not voted on this point once.
Well, the question is, do you affirm the decisions made in October to replace discretion with right to require that the borrowing is with the same lender? And now we've been discussing this for 45 minutes.
I think we have voted on borrowing the same lender on consortium. I don't think we have voted on discretion.
No. We have voted in October. No. So what has changed in the meantime that we are in second round having this very lengthy discussion?
Evidently the question is coming back, so something must have caused us to bring it up.
The only
reason it's in front of us, we talk about it. And unfortunately, we don't stay with the same boat all the time, because at least I have forgotten part of this in the 5 months that has passed.
Why have you brought it back, April? I think is Jan's question.
Why we brought these questions back was because in October, when we did the staff paper, we worded everything in terms of, does the entity have a right to postpone settlement for at least 12 months? And at the end of that discussion, it was pointed out to the staff that actually the principle in the standard is it defines what the criterion are for current, not for non-current. Now, in practice, we think it gives you the same answer whether you're looking at it from a basis of is it non-current or current, because they're mirror images of each other. But we did bring it back just to put the argument in terms of paragraph 69 of the standard, which is the principle in the standard. And we don't think it should give a different answer.
So we've turned over the October decisions, having debated it at length in October and agreed. And now Michael's asking one more simple question. I thought during our discussion earlier
today
that we had agreed that right was better than discretion. So
yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I think that. Now, the paper in paragraphs 33 to 45 discuss whether or not we would also make it on the same or similar terms, but I think that discussion is now superseded by the previous decisions. So we'll go straight to the second part of the paper, which looks at the effect of events after the reporting period on the right to defer settlement. And in paragraph 47 of the paper, we show a table of the existing guidance in the standard. And from that, we think it's clear that only rights in place at the end of the reporting period should affect the classification of liabilities. But we recommend that this is made explicit by the amendments proposed in paragraphs 50 and 51 of the paper to include rights at the end of the reporting period in both paragraph 69D and 73. Do you agree?
Agreed.
Yes. Fine. The paper then discusses how events after the reporting period affect how a right to defer settlement is applied, and that's in paragraph 52 to 70 of the paper. Now, because it's only rights that are in place at the end of the reporting period that can affect classification, events after the reporting period can never create a right to defer settlement, and so events after the reporting period cannot result in a current liability being reclassified as a non-current liability. The only effect that events after the reporting period can have on classification is to prevent the right to defer settlement that exists at the reporting date from being applied, i.e. from you can turn a non-current classification into a current classification. Now, when we discussed this in October, you considered two types of events after the reporting date. When management expects to be in breach of a borrowing covenant that would render the loan repayable immediately, or when management chooses to repay a loan earlier than required. Now, we recommend that if management expects to be prevented from exercising a right to defer settlement, or chooses not to exercise that right, that should be reflected in the classification decision. If management expect to repay the loan within 12 months, or they think that a breach will render the loan repayable, then the liability should be classified as current. Do you agree with that?
No. If I have a loan which has another 3 years to go, and I think most likely the market is better now, I can find other solutions or whatever. I still have that loan as a long-term loan. Even though I say I will most likely pay it back. I intend to pay it back. If there's something that doesn't give me the right then I accept it. But if I have sort of an unconditional at my discretion to do that, I think it's not, it's a long term.
Right. I mean, interestingly, in the last discussions, one of the board members did say that if there was any doubt, they would prefer...
doubt of what?
Whether or not it will be settled early, they prefer it to be shown as current.
Why should it be settled? Why would it be current if you have the right to keep it for 3 years? Perhaps I will prepay the 3 year loan and take another 3 year loan because the market is better, so I can use my clause prepay without any penalty.
But you'd still want that shown as non-current?
Yes. This question is we have a kind of a time interval. After at the end of the reporting period until the issue date of authorization. Yeah. So management can see some special events. So they can have some kind of a valid expectation. So that's why maybe the question 5 and question 6 must be integrated together. Maybe that may be more easy to answer the question 5.
The core principle is we account for contracts, we don't account for intentions.
Although, Jan, if you look at 69A of the standards currently written, it does talk about classification as current when the entity expects to settle the liability within its normal operating cycle. And so that's what we've brought into this analysis here to say, look, if you are planning now to actually settle the liability within 12 months, then we would propose a current classification. And that would give indication, that would give information to users of financial statements that there's an expected outflow of cash more sooner than otherwise would be indicated.
I wouldn't read this within the operating cycle as saying that.
Mary?
Even if I accept the basic premise of management intent being factored in, I had some concerns with us continuing to open up expectations because I thought we were crossing over a line, depending upon in part how we drafted it, that would create a very significant and new obligation when doing the classification to almost go into the type of projections that you have to for going concern assessments in terms of forecasting compliance over at least the next 12 months with own loan with existing loan covenants. So if we say factor in intent, which is then your basis for saying intent includes expectations, I think we have to look very, very carefully and consider further consultation about whether we're really changing whether we're creating a big change in something that we think is a wording change.
Martin?
When I thought really, man, what we are doing here is this kind of disclosure of liquidity risk of an entity. And I thought we said, okay, we now stick to rights. But now it comes into, okay, what is the expectation of management, how they will manage their liquidity after really reporting date. And I really think it's too much. And I could not imagine that management sitting after year end and go to all their loan facilities and have an expectation if they want to continue and exercise this right or not, or what could prevent. I think it's totally non-operational. So I think we should stick to the right, if they have a right, really to use this loan facility and renew it into the 12 months, that is right and should we do that, but not really include management intention and expectation after reporting or at reporting date.
Okay, I think why we've brought this in is because in the discussions in October, a number of board members were concerned that at the year end, you might actually at that stage have a right to defer settlement, but that management might know that things would deteriorate after the reporting date, and that they knew that they would actually have to repay the loan early because they would be in breach.
But that is a totally different question. There's two different types of expectations we're dealing with here. Intent, what do I think I'm going to do, and what do I think might happen to me? And I think it was the I think might happen to me that we said, well, if I think that I'm going to cross the line, if I think I'm going to actually be forced to repay this because I've defaulted or whatever, then it seems then it seems useful information in the way that Patricia described it earlier to put that in. But if I just think I might decide that it's a nice idea to repay the loan, that feels too much into the intent space. And I'm just getting a little bit confused about which question we're dealing with on that.
Well, at the moment, the question is worded that both, but it sounds as though the board members would think that if management will be forced to repay early because they're likely to be in breach, then that should be anticipated and it should be shown as current. But if management have the option to do what they want, they may, then that we wouldn't take their intent or their expectations into account in that case.
But I think the phrase you just used, because they are likely to be in breach, says, okay, when you're doing your classification at the reporting date, you must, as management, make an assessment of all the covenants on all your borrowings and the likelihood of breaching them. And I'm just saying, let us not underestimate the significance of imposing that requirement.
Yeah. The reverse is if you do have information saying you're going to be in breach, are we saying
I think we keep moving. Amara? Make this a conversation. Let's have what you think and get on with it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I think we are over-engineering this, to be honest. When I read paragraph 69 and the changes we made, I think that's enough. Going beyond what I expect in the future, 69A, for instance, consider the operating cycle. If my operating cycle is 5 years, I'm talking here about expectations after the end of the reporting period. So it's 5 years then?
No.
It's 10 years, so I think we are over-engineering. We don't need this. But application of 69 would be enough.
To be fair to April, she brought it back because that's what...
No, this is new.
Yes, but she said as a result of the discussion in October why it's been brought back.
No, that's okay. I'm not saying that she did
Philippe.
Without our request.
I'm afraid we are confusing disclosures and classification here. Seems to me we have a principle in IS 10, subsequent events, that either subsequent events are adjusting events or just disclosure events, right? Here, if you are perfectly correct, out of the balance sheet date, you have a non-current liability and you fulfill the criteria to be non-current at the balance sheet date, that is okay for classification. If subsequently there is a new expectation, a new event, that doesn't change the existing situation of the balance sheet date, but it is really a subsequent event, that would be disclosed as something which is important to know, but I don't think it would affect the classification, which was okay, and is still okay at the balance sheet date.
Okay. I'm getting a feeling that most people are not for this in total anyway. April, could you kind of summarize what you think you've heard?
What I think I've heard is that we agree the early changes that we made to 69D. Sorry, let me just... we'll delete unconditional from paragraph 69D. We'll replace discretion in paragraph 73. We'll link the settlement of the liability with the transfer of cash, other assets or services. We'll extend, but we won't change paragraph 73 to include the same lender or to deal with the circumstances where we've got a consortium. And because of that, we then won't go into a discussion of same or similar terms. We agreed that only rights in place at the reporting date should affect the classification of a liability, but we won't make the other changes that prevent the application of the right after the reporting date. And because we've done that, obviously we're not going to consider whether or not we should take information in right after the authorization date. The only question then that remains is the question about did we want to, in the draft proposal, we have reorganized the existing requirements so that similar types of examples are grouped together because we think that that is clearer for people reading it.
Okay.
Is everybody happy with having the examples regrouped?
Reorganization of the paragraphs.
Yeah. Okay. Is that... adequate for you to take
that? I have one final question. Are we going to re-expose this? Or are we going to a final standard?
Well, we haven't exposed it at all yet.
Well, it was, there was the
improvement
there was the annual,
the
improvement
annual the annual improvement was so completely different that this would be an exposure drop in its own right of a narrow focus amendment to IS1.
Chuck, just a question. I don't disagree with staff's recommendations and the direction of what we are going to do. However, I can't. There is one thing I can't understand how it operates. So, for example, if you have a long-term payable, which could be renewed, and then after the closing date, you recognize you have to repay, so you would reclassify it before the. Can you take this up with the staff? Sorry? Can you take this up with the staff out of session? No. I think it's important. Okay. It must be discussed at the board table. So then, but if this is the kind of package deal with the account receivable, long-term account receivable, so then at the same time, you could shorten the long-term receivable. Then you noticed it after the closing date. Then in this standard, you would require to reclassify the loan only. So then what will happen to the receivable side?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
You have a long-term project, kind of project. And then the original condition was it's a short-term. Then, but there is a possibility of renew. So then, the both side would be renewed.
Why is there a linked receivable and payable?
Because if you are engaged in the kind of the project, and it depends on the project management, how it goes. So then, the cash flow depends on the project management. Then the original project management was, within 1 year. But because of some reason, there is a large possibility to extend. And then finally, at the end of the closing date, you decided it's a long-term payable, not current. On the asset side, it's also long-term receivable. But after the reporting date, you would recognize it. You can rearrange all these cash flow arrangement or rearrange the project itself. Then, in that case, if you just look at the creditor side, you have to reclassify it. That's what we are going to require. But my question is, what will happen to the debit side?
Well, I don't actually think that we are reclassifying the liability for events after the reporting period. I think that was the discussion we've had today.
But you are saying that it's a exception of unadjusting event.
If you're talking about paragraph 73, where if you have an existing arrangement that allows you to roll over the existing arrangement after date, then that would be a non-current liability. But I don't see that arrangement, which would normally be a borrowing arrangement with a lender, would have a trade receivable attached to it or linked with it.
Yeah, not contract basis, but the project basis, if the situation is saved.
The proposal in the staff paper about an exception to IS 10, the board has disagreed with, so we're not progressing that. No.
Okay. All right, we'll take a 5 minute break.
Could I just ask April to clarify one thing which wasn't clear to me from her summary? What happens if you have the right at the reporting date, but you expect not to be able to exercise the right? For example, if you expect to be in breach.
I think the conclusion of most of the people here was that you wouldn't adjust that to current.
I think it stays silent.
Yeah.
We're not changing that. We're not doing anything about that.
Okay. 5 minute break. We'll come back and be efficient.